I guess I need to ask the question, Elaine, as to whether you're asking me what I feel my responsibility is to the African American community. Is that the question? Mm-hmm.
The reason I'm asking that is clearly you've made a contribution, and because, you know, no, people would not, you've made a contribution to bettering life, etc., or you would not be have been mentioned. And so there must have been at some time where you said, this isn't fair, or that's not fair, or this should be done, or that should be done.
Okay, now I understand.
Okay.
My responsibility and my obligation
has
been to the whole Detroit community, and I certainly have been aware since I've been a very young person of serious discrimination against African Americans in our country and in our city. So I have chosen on as many occasions as possible to join with the African American community in its efforts to fight against discrimination, prejudice. I've done this both as a teacher, as a citizen of the city, and in my role, in my professional roles as city council member, as director of the mental health board, and in all of the non-paying roles that I've had. So if that gets me viewed positively by some members of the Black community or the African American community, that's fine. I've done essentially, however, what I felt was right to do.
Starting now, what I'd like to do now is go back at sort of the beginnings of your career.
Sure.
And these that you've just mentioned, as you go through, you know, give me sort of a synopsis of where you've gone.
Sure.
And then maybe expand in those areas where these things have come up.
Okay, I guess perhaps the first public awareness, I have my own background and such, both at home and in terms of my associates, my general upbringing in the city of Detroit, has been to produce a person who was as unbiased racially, religiously, ethnically, as one could be. And I make no claim to being, you know, perfectly non-biased. I don't know who is. But my upbringing, my reading, my professional training, for example, in anthropology and sociology, have conditioned me to view people as people, period, absent any other consideration. So with that as a kind of basic background, I was quite active during the period of the 50s in working for open occupancy housing.
Okay.
I was part, for example, of an archdiocesan team of people, and I am not Roman Catholic, but they did not make that as any requirement. They just pulled in a number of us who would be going around, particularly to fringe area communities and into the suburbs, doing community meetings, educational meetings, and pointing out the appropriateness and the fairness of open occupancy housing.
This was in the 50s?
Oh yes, this was in the 50s. I remember working with such people, for example, as the late Monsignor Kern, Beulah Whitby, who was then deputy director of the Community Relations Department, Richard Marks, I believe also Arthur Johnson, a number of us would be involved in these panels that were set up primarily through the archdiocese. Mm-hmm. We'd go out to different parishes and draw a crowd and draw controversy, mm-hmm. but respond to questions. Mm-hmm. And
what were the kinds of, how did the meetings go? What were the kinds of things that went on? Were they sometimes hostile? Were they?
Oh yes, often hostile, but mostly there was a core of people who were receptive at the given parish
mm-hmm.
to receive such a group.
Mm-hmm.
But then when the notice was sent out in that general parish
mm-hmm.
that we're having a discussion on open occupancy
mm-hmm.
housing,
mm-hmm.
there would be critical people,
mm-hmm.
hostile people mm-hmm. coming too. And this, I remind you, was what, almost 30 to 40 years ago. So that the attitude was extremely hostile.
Was this before or after restrictive covenants were they legal at that time, the time that you're talking about?
No, I believe restrictive covenants, and I you'll need to check this.
Yeah,
but I think that 1948 was the time that
they were abolished.
Mm-hmm. But we had opposition here in the city of Detroit, and certainly in the suburbs, from such groups, for instance, as the Northwest Federated Civic Associations, which was an organization of organizations, and who on up until, I would say, 1962, the election when I came into office, was a very powerful organization. They, in conjunction with a good number of real estate brokers, were involved in keeping neighborhoods
mm-hmm.
Closed
mm-hmm.
to not only African Americans, but also Jews, Italians, etc. This was somewhat around the time, maybe a little even before, the infamous Grosse Pointe point system mm-hmm. came to public attention.
Okay.
And I don't know if you're familiarity with that, if you're familiar with
yes,
that.
Yes, somewhat.
Okay. I think this was even before that.
Okay.
And I mention that point system simply as an illustration of the kind of thing that was going on
mm-hmm.
in southeastern Michigan and doubtless elsewhere in the country as well. And it was that we were seeking to educate against
mm-hmm.
In many of these activities. I guess I was also chairperson of a group that we had put together. I can't remember the name of it now, but it was advocating open occupancy
mm-hmm.
housing. We thought that was a pretty fundamental solution to problems of education, to problems of family development,
mm-hmm.
etc., if people could be allowed to live where they wished
mm-hmm.
to live. So that was a start. I was also active with the Coordinating Council on Community Relations. I think I gave my first main public speech before that group sometime in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
I need also to mention another role that I guess parallels this, maybe led into my involvement with this archdiocesan open occupancy panel. And that is that in 1953, I had not quite completed my doctorate at the University, Wayne State, or at University of Michigan. I was teaching at Wayne State at the time, but I had not finished my doctorate at the University of Michigan, and there was a rule that apparently was invoked saying that I could not continue teaching full-time because I didn't have my doctorate mm-hmm. at the end of 4 years of teaching. Okay, I needed a full-time job in addition to the part-time teaching that they allowed. And so I went to work for the Detroit City Plan Commission at that time, and shortly as a staff sociologist. The title was social economist, but they meant sociologist. After a very short period there, I was asked to go out and organize block clubs as part of the federal program of neighborhood conservation. And this began the federal legislation had been adopted, I believe, in 1952. Detroit was gearing up in 53. I was hired in October of 53. By about a year later, at the end of 54, I was out trying to organize block clubs in our so-called pilot neighborhood, which was on Detroit's east side, in the area north of Mack, east of Bellevue, up to Van Dyke, and as far north as Forest, or Warren. I think it was Warren. A 35-block area, which I then proceeded to organize block by block. And there my experiences were related to race relations in that this was a racially changing neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
It had been principally a German-Italian area before, as witness, for example, at Max and Maxwell, what was known as the Deutsches Haus, subsequently transformed into a black church.
Okay.
But when I arrived on the scene in the mid-1950s to organize that neighborhood, I found a situation where white people were looking outward and elsewhere. Black people were new in the area, were hesitant and unsure of their place in the neighborhood with regard to the older white residents.
Mm-hmm.
And the effort to organize block clubs was a fascinating kind of thing. I got black and white people to come together into each other's homes for the first time ever,
mm-hmm.
because we'd call a block club meeting,
mm-hmm.
and we'd get them to sit down, and they began to see that mm-hmm. their problems were the same. For example, alley problems. We had many, in those days, there were still many old barn-like structures in the backyards
mm-hmm.
that had been left over from an earlier era
uh-huh.
that needed to be torn down. Some were falling apart. And so we made the alley the focus of our first action efforts
mm-hmm.
to consolidate the thinking of the people of the neighborhood. And the block club as an instrument for racial integration was an interesting device, worked. And the focus on common problems worked. So I organized that whole neighborhood, with the help of a number of volunteers that I gathered from around the city, from, for example, the Detroit Association of Social Workers. I got lots of people. I was never trained as an organizer, but I found I liked it
mm-hmm.
and did well at it. Interestingly, in that regard, that experience as a sociologist for the City Plan Commission, the old City Plan Commission under the old charter,
mm-hmm.
there were a number of churches in that neighborhood that I approached, asking them for the opportunity to hold meetings at the church.
Mm-hmm.
In several instances, two particularly. I recall running into white pastors who said that this was unheard of, couldn't possibly be done. One of them was the East Grand Boulevard Methodist Church.
Mm-hmm.
Right at Gratiot and East Grand Boulevard there, the minister said that association would lead to meetings would lead to association, and association would lead to amalgamation. Those were his words. You know, a weird guy, but he was subsequently replaced by a black clergyman, a Reverend White. The churches, incidentally, were in the midst of this turmoil too, as to what to do in these changing neighborhoods. I recall working with Raleigh Sane, whom you may remember was the director of the Detroit Council of Churches.
Yeah, I don't remember him, but the name sounds...
Well, working with Raleigh, I secured data as to the movement of all of the Protestant churches in Detroit and where they went. And it was just a map that showed that they're going out into the hills, Farmington Hills or whatever, hills or woods or whatever else, but a map that showed arrows from here out.
Mm-hmm.
It was a fascinating map, based, I know, largely on an inability or an unwillingness or a prejudice so deep in the congregation that they could not stay.
Mm-hmm.
Some few churches did stay. Come to them in a minute. But there was another one over on Iroquois and Mac. Can't think of the name of the church, but there was a minister there who also would not allow me to have racially mixed meetings. But I finally won his support, and he allowed that to happen, and then nothing eventful or untoward occurred, and seemed to go all right. There were a few of them who opened their doors. I remember a St. Mark's Lutheran Church on the boulevard, a Reverend Kurth, a bright person who was aware that that neighborhood was changing and who welcomed having black parishioners. So it was not all one way or the other. That incidentally was an experience where I met another person soon to be famous, now recently deceased. At that time, there was at St. Mary's Episcopal Church on Canfield near Van Dyke, a young black pastor who had been placed there because the Episcopal Church was aware of the changing race of the neighborhood, and that was John Walker. Do you remember John Walker went on from Detroit to become the Bishop of Washington in the Episcopal Church? And John and I became good friends, and John just recently died within the last couple of years, I believe. But he became a renowned Episcopal Bishop of Washington, D.C. So it was an exciting experience, and my opportunity in the field and on the ground to bring people together without that being the primary intention. The primary intention was to conserve a neighborhood, and we kept people's focus on that. But in doing that, it's possible to it happened. Broke down many of their stereotypes.
Now, today, you know, if somebody says I'm leaving Detroit, I mean, you can understand to some, you know, some extent, because you have the crime and tremendous problems. But then, when, you know, that wasn't an issue with the people who were moving into neighborhoods.
Fairly good neighborhood.
Right. They were in good neighborhoods. These people were hardworking and probably clean and neat, and so on. So there wasn't, you couldn't say, well, you know, somebody moved in, so there's going to be a crack house down the street. Now, then what, you know, from what you heard, what would people, what would be their reasons? Because, you know, from what you told me in terms of, from my readings, you know, people are people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what do those people think about black people that made them feel
reason
something was
has
wrong?
Nothing to do with it. That's the
what did they
flaw
say?
In the question.
What
they
did
didn't say anything. They were just fearful.
Mm-hmm.
They had grown up, you see. They'd been socialized to believe that black people meant trouble, meant crime, meant particularly the concern was property value. Now, whether
mm-hmm.
that was a smokescreen or what,
mm-hmm.
but that was a concern.
Right, and so even if they didn't have their own really strong prejudices, they didn't want to lose money, so they'd go.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
right. So they could rationalize
mm-hmm.
it however they
yeah.
wanted to. Well, that experience led to my and my increasing visibility around the city. In organizing not only that pilot neighborhood. We got started doing that, and I gradually acquired a small staff of about half a dozen people
mm-hmm.
at the Plan Commission, and we were called on to organize here, everywhere around the city. So much so, as a matter of fact, that then Mayor Louis Mariani removed us from the aegis of the City Plan Commission, which was a very benevolent administrative base
mm-hmm.
to work from with a very decent and good director,
mm-hmm.
Charles Blessing.
Mm-hmm.
They moved us in 1960 over to the Detroit Housing Commission, which was run in a kind of military fashion. The lights
okay.
would go on at 8 in the morning, they'd go off at 12 noon, people had 1 hour for lunch, they'd be back at 4 o'clock, everybody went home. Well, that didn't lend itself to my group's activities. We worked at night, we'd come in at 10, 11 o'clock, because
mm-hmm.
we'd be out the night before, but I stayed there for about 6 weeks to get my staff settled. Then I left and subsequently ran for the city council because in the process of organizing block clubs, I had built a political base, which was not my intent, but it happened. Also, I was a candidate for, there was a need to have a new director of the Housing Commission. A new director of the Housing Commission. At that point, and here I need to relate to another well-known Detroiter, two of them as a matter of fact. One was Bill Patrick,
mm-hmm.
first black council member in recent history. Someone says that back in the 1800s there was a black council member, but I've never
yeah,
checked
I think
that out.
Was. Mm-hmm.
But Bill was elected to the city council in 1957, and our paths came together through mutual friends, and he and I became friends. And somewhere, somewhere about 1958. I guess it was the vacancy on the city council, on the housing commission, came to light, and I was nominated for that position by Damon Keith, as a matter of fact. Damon must be on your list.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I was nominated by Damon, who was then on the housing commission, and with Bill Patrick's support, I guess I had one vote when it came time to vote, so I didn't get the position. Mark Hurley, got the position as director of the Housing Commission at that time. I mention this because it was a clear indication to me of strong support from leadership of the black community for me. That was subsequently translated into political support when I did run for the city council in 1961. Let me pause for a moment here. Do you have another question, or do you want me to just go on?
No, go on.
Just go on, okay.
I did want to go back. Were you going to go on about Bill Patrick?
I was going to go on and begin to tell you about my involvement with the city council.
Okay. I wanted to, do you know where Bill Patrick is?
If Bill is still alive, and I think he is, he would be somewhere in New York, and I know had a place on Martha's Vineyard. Now, I know his wife died. Bill worked, after being a council member here, he served 1.5 terms. He and I served together from 1962 through 1963. Then he resigned from the Detroit City Council in midterm, and I think went to work for Michigan Bell Telephone. Subsequent to that, he became the president of New Detroit after probably about 1964 or 5. He became president of New Detroit and then rejoined Michigan Bell, went to New York, where he served as an attorney for Michigan Bell, and I have not I've not seen him, but he's, I know, have been back from time to time to Detroit.
Okay. I haven't been able to locate him.
Damon Keith might know.
Okay.
That would be one person who I think would know.
Okay, we can go on.
Okay, let me see. Okay, I think we're at the point where I returned to the university after leaving the Housing Commission for a short period, and by then I had had my doctorate in 55, so I was able to come back full-time to the university as an assistant professor, and it was from that vantage point that I ran for City Council in 1961 and was elected as part of a major wave of involvement of the black community. Has anyone reported to you on that particular election?
No.
Okay. That was, in my judgment, the watershed election that changed the future of all Detroit City politics, because out of it came an increasingly empowered black community. The situation was this. The incumbent mayor was Louis Mariani, who had come to office, I believe, in 1956, following the death during his term of Mayor Cobo. Mariani was then council president, succeeded him, served out that term, ran for election, I believe, in 57, was elected in 57, and was seeking another term in 61. Prior to the election of 1961, just prior to it, a series of events occurred in Detroit, including one or two murders, and the blame was placed on the black community, although there was no evidence that it was a black murderer. A dragnet was put out and hundreds, I believe I'm correct in saying something like 12 to 1500 black people were picked up in short order, including Art Johnson. So when you get to talk mm-hmm. to Arthur, he'll know. Yeah. He was standing in front of his house, if I remember correctly,
yeah,
and was picked up there.
Harold Norris, I talked to Harold Norris.
Harold tell
did,
you about
yeah,
that?
Yeah, he did tell me about that.
We are all, in a way, within perhaps 5 to 10 years of each mm-hmm. other, contemporaries, mm-hmm. and Harold would certainly yeah. know about this, and yeah. may even have been one of the lawyers
right.
involved
right.
in defense.
Yeah.
Right. Excellent, excellent person. That's one event that occurred, that backdrop. At the same time, or maybe later in the year, maybe after the primary election, and I was nominated as one of the 18 people to run mm-hmm. In the general election, mm-hmm. but sometime in early October, Council member William T. Patrick introduced an ordinance amendment to, I believe it was, the Community Relations Ordinance, and it was known as the Patrick Amendment. I don't think I can give you the details of what that Patrick Amendment was, but that's not terribly important. It was the outcry against that Patrick Amendment and for it that really helped to galvanize the black community to assert itself politically.
Okay.
And at that point, a battle cry went up in the black community. Battle cry being 5+1. And on that 5+1 theme, you need to talk to Horace Sheffield, Jr.
Okay.
Because Horace and the late Buddy Battle, but particularly Horace,
okay.
was the architect of that battle cry and of the efforts through the Trade Union Leadership Council
mm-hmm.
to move the black community to get 5 trusted liberal council members and a new mayor. And the reason for the 5+1was because the Patrick Amendment failed.
What was
5-4. The Patrick Amendment, as I say, I can't give you the details of it, but it had something to do with improving the Community Relations Commission of the City of Detroit.
Okay.
And it was opposed by 5 council members. 4 supported it, and you know what happens when 4 support it and 5 do not, it loses. So that loss turned into a political gain.
Okay.
And the 5+1 theme emerged out of that. And the 5 of us were the 4 liberal councilmen who had supported the Patrick Amendment.
Okay.
And they needed a 5th. And I became the non-incumbent whom they wanted to get elected to make a 5-member liberal community.
Okay. Who were they?
The 4 of them were Mr. Patrick, Ed Carey, Ed Connor, and Mary Beck. Mary Beck does not generally have an image of being a liberal, but she was a fair-minded mm-hmm. person who on that issue voted for the Patrick Amendment. The other 5 included Billy Rogel, Del Smith, Blanche Parent-Wise, I believe Eugene Van Antwerp, and one other, Youngblood. And in the subsequent election, not only did the 5+1 team prevail, the 5 of us were elected, I for the first time, the others re-elected. That was the year that Jerry Cavanaugh became the unlikely choice, but the mayor of Detroit, as a result of the black communities coming together and being out there voting. And we also got rid of three members of the council at that time. Got rid of Del Smith, Blanche Parent Wise, and I believe Youngblood. That's when Jim Brickley came into office along with me as a newcomer, and Tony Wierzbicki came in as a newcomer. Okay, quickly now, because I have about 15 minutes more, and I can meet again with you if you want, but I've got to leave in about 15 minutes. The next phase of my involvement in terms of black history had to do with, let me just quickly say two things. One was the Patrick Rabbit's open occupancy ordinance. Now, with Bill and myself on the council, we put together this ordinance, and it was considered. So big was the public hearing on that ordinance, so vigorous was the opposition, we couldn't hold it here, it was too small. We went across to the Ford Auditorium for an unprecedented public hearing.
What year was this?
This was about 1963.
Okay.
It would have to have been 63.
Okay.
63, yeah, sure, it was 63. Patrick was still around. The new term began in 62, and now it could have been late 62 or 63.
Is that,
which gives residential property owners freedom to reject on racial or other grounds.
Let me not interrupt you.
We lost 7-2. Even the so-called liberals on the council who were elected with us would not go along with an ordinance that opened the city to people without regard to race.
Well, if restrictive covenants were illegal, wasn't that a given?
There were all sorts of other devices that could be used.
Such as?
Steering people by real estate brokers, just refusing to show people. There were no penalties either.
Mm-hmm.
See, an ordinance provides penalties. So that if we found somebody who did, we wanted the law to say that this is the way in which Detroit, policy-wise, was going to behave.
So the end of the restrictive covenants just meant you couldn't have it written down.
That's exactly
but you could
right.
still do
of
it.
Of course, yes.
Okay.
Without penalty.
So it continued. It didn't end.
That's right. And it wasn't until much later that the city council finally adopted an open occupancy ordinance after it was meaningless because African Americans had moved to all parts of the city. But in 1963, it was very much of a problem. All sorts of threats, violence, bomb threats, etc. We had tires slashed, we had, bomb threats, all kinds of things, police in front of my house, protect my family, and so on. And I'll never forget the hearing over at the Ford Auditorium while we were booed and booed and booed, and they had the votes, so it was rejected. It was also during this time, I think it was 63, yeah, wasn't 63 the year that Dr. King was in town?
Yeah.
And marched here in Detroit, I was involved in that march, and Bill and I, Bill Patrick and I, flew off later that year to Washington to be in the...
The Washington March?
Yeah, you may be interested in just seeing this little memento of ours.
Oh.
We were lucky enough to get up onto the memorial.
That's a beautiful picture.
Yes, and so we're standing on the memorial. There's the stage and all the speakers, and somebody took this from the back of the memorial out this way. So, yes, this is one of my prized possessions. We had flown in that morning with the UAW, who had a plane chartered to go to Washington, and they kindly took Bill and me, and we flew back that night. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, and this is really a sidelight, but I think of interest, on our way back at the airport, who should we run into but Malcolm X, who was at the airport.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I didn't know Malcolm at the time, but Bill did.
Mm-hmm.
And Malcolm had stopped us, and Bill introduced me, and we chatted for a few minutes. And he said, Malcolm said, well, Mr. Kennedy managed that one pretty well, didn't he, the demonstration.
Mm-hmm.
And he said he had watched the proceedings from a hotel room because he didn't believe in that
mm-hmm.
kind of action.
Mm-hmm.
So that was an interesting sidelight experience, and his observation on the march in Washington. But it was a very dramatic period. What else? We had a number of other pieces of legislation, resolutions, etc., that sought to provide an end to prejudice and discrimination in the city of Detroit. And I just mentioned that in passing as, I guess, some further indication of why it would be that I would be one of the white members of the community who might be called on to comment.
Mm-hmm.
So my involvement with the black community was pretty deep.
Mm-hmm.
If you check back, for example, in terms of the Michigan Chronicle, which was then a much freer and more open publication, and not simply a mouthpiece for the mayor, for any mayor, but it was a much different publication. 2-3 times, I guess, I was chosen among their persons of the year, etc.
Mm-hmm.
So the involvement was deep,
mm-hmm.
and it comes right from the grassroots with block clubs
mm-hmm.
and the like. Okay, where do we go from there? Let's move it along to 1970. I'd been on the council for 2 terms, was re-elected and became president of the council in 1969, and found that I had, and I'm just picking out related items to the African-American
community. That's great.
I found, for example, that we had an almost all-white secretarial staff here. So, as the opportunity arose, we changed that. When my secretary left, for example, retired, because I had inherited her, and she was a nice enough and able secretary,
mm-hmm.
but she and her husband retired and went to Florida. So that was the first occasion for me to choose somebody else. And I hired a black secretary. And Sally Lynch, who's over in the clerk's office, I hired her. I hired Mary Burnett, another black secretary who served until she retired. Val Crum, who worked with Irma, I hired her back in the early 70s. So I essentially integrated the secretarial staff up here. Did it quietly, but did it.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it was became known that it was done.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's done. It was done without any problems or any opposition. Just
mm-hmm.
you did it. So that was another piece of involvement with the black community. What else? Okay, I have to note the mayor's race of 1973. And I guess I'll need to stop at that point in terms of time.
Okay.
But if you wish, we can
reschedule. Yeah, I'd like to do that because it's time for you to go now.
Yeah, but I just want to mention one more item, and that is the race of 1973, where the black community was split, very deeply split, the candidates included, Coleman Young, John Nichols, arch-conservative police chief, and darling of the segregationist forces in Detroit, the late Ed Bell, attorney and former circuit court judge, John Moak, law professor from Wayne State, and myself. Now, there were a few others, but those were the five most known candidates. The black community was divided sharply in regard to me. Not any feelings of hostility, but there was the opportunity to elect a black mayor. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, I even need to go back to 1969. Because in 1969, I was planning to run for mayor, which would have been the time for me to have run. Mm-hmm. However, I was urged by both black and white leadership friends, including Walter Reuther, not to run then, because one Richard Austin, good friend of mine, good person, was going to be the candidate for mayor that they wanted to support. They felt that even if he would not make it, it was important to have a black candidate of stature. So I was told, we'll support you for council president, and they did, and I was elected council president, and was expecting support in 1973. Except that Walter died in the period between, and the UAW gave me the endorsement, but there were also large numbers of black unionists who supported Coleman. And I don't think I lost any of the support of the black community, except that I should not run for mayor. They preferred to have the first black mayor of Detroit, which I understand.
Yeah.
So let's stop at that point,
okay,
and we can reschedule.
Okay.